I'm here in South County Dublin and I'm talking to Reggie Goodbody. Reggie, we're going to talk about a very interesting part of your life here in the city of Dublin, working in a timber factory. But lead me into that. Talk to me first about how you came here and why you came here.
Well, I was brought up in Ireland and educated in Ireland. And in 1956, I left school, and as there was very little job opportunities in Ireland, I decided to go to England, where my father had arranged a job for me. And I started off on the princely sum of £2.75 or £2.15 a week. My father gave me 10 shillings. And I went to Worcester, and I worked in a timber yard there as, I suppose, theoretically a management trainee. And at the age of 19, I was moved over a weekend to Nottingham, where they had another branch, because they were setting up one of the first DIY shops in England, which was opened by Barry Bucknell at the time, television man at the time, I still remember it. And after I was sort of helping in the shop, and then the manager was accidentally killed. He dived into the sea, and the wave went out, and he hit the bottom and broke his neck. And as a result of that, I became manager of the shop at the age of 19. And I carried on that for, I think, 2 or 3 years. And eventually in 1960, I was getting a bit fed up with the way I was not being paid the way I thought I should be. £10 a week, you couldn't do an awful lot. Lived in digs and ran a bicycle. And it was getting a bit, I was fed up. So my mother, fortunately, sent me over a cutting for an advertisement for a supervisor in a box factory in Dublin. And I thought this was interesting, and I wrote to the people concerned, and they wrote back and said, yes, would you come over for an interview? So I got on the boat and went over to Dublin, and I had the interview, which took most of a day. I can still remember it. And I interviewed them, and they interviewed me. And
where did this take part?
This took part in Dublin, in a place number 10, Hill Street. Hill Street is off Parnell Street. It's not far from Mountjoy Square. And the name of the company was Legg Brothers, which, according to the office, the Legg Brothers sign is still there, and the date is there, and I have a photograph of 1864. Was it when that company started. Now, what they did was make wooden boxes, wooden bread trays, packing cases, and later, I was there for about 10 years, so towards the end, we started making the first wooden pallets. And this was a specialized sort of semi-craft type industry, very... there were a lot of these small businesses in the inner city of Dublin in those days. There were all sorts of, it's hard to name them, but there were small breweries up in Mountjoy Breweries. There were leather works, there were iron works, there was a taxi firm up the road. There was Orware across the road. They did overalls and made them. There was a printing works, Dorset Printing Press and Works, and it was across the road from us. And this industry had been there probably since 1864. When I was there, there were a total number of people employed was about 43. So it was a very labor-intensive type business. And basically, the company bought in European redwood or whitewood from Scandinavia or Russia. It was what's known as sixth quality, which was the lowest grade of timber available. It was absolute the bottom, except when occasionally they bought what's known as Russian sleepers, and they were the most beautiful bit of redwood that you've ever seen. They were 10 by 7 inches, and they were 9 foot long, and some of it was most wonderful textured timber, first growth timber. Mm-hmm. But they imported this timber from Scandinavia, and they bought it through timber agents, and there was a timber agent called Dorman's was one name that I can remember, and Whittaker's was another. And these agents used to say, they'd go out and see the mills in Scandinavia, and they'd say, we're looking for the following specification for a box company or for the timber providers like Brooks Thomas or Heaton's or some of the big ones. And They then would come to our company and say, we can get you a consignment, that's what the price will be. And they took the 1.5% or 2%, whatever it was. And the whole consignment then came over, and it was randomly packed. In other words, it was loosely packed into the hold of the ship. So every piece was handed in by hand. It was all random widths and it was random lengths. So it came straight off the sawmill. Nowadays, everything is packaged and bundled and it's all to the standard length and standard size and everything else, and it's just like coming out of a machine. But this timber arrived in the nor in the Dublin in the docks. There was a cross berth, was one place it used to come in, and it was unloaded by the dockers and loaded onto lorries and brought up to Legg Brothers. And I suppose it's probably been horse and cart at one stage, but certainly when I was there, it was lorries. And the lorries would come up, and the pieces used to be unloaded from the lorries with the labourers in the yard, and the helpers in the lorry. And they were it was at that stage it was piled into piles of different widths and thicknesses, but the length was still random.
Now, could you describe what the place looked like when you were
Well,
there?
this yard, I suppose, was about a quarter of an acre or thereabouts. Might have been half, a quarter to half an acre in total area. There was a sawmill on the corner. Above the sawmill was an assembly loft. And the yard itself was where the timber was stacked. And the process was then to hand trolleys went out and brought in cartloads of timber into a crosscut saw. And that saw chopped the timber into lengths of, say, probably 4 foot or thereabouts for whatever we were going to make out of it. When that was then put onto things called stillages, which were a small pallet, and they were wheeled into the bandsaws. There were two bandsaws. There were actually three bandsaws there. These were what are known as wide bandsaws. They were made by a firm called Stenner in England. The blades were 5.5 inches wide, and they just sliced through timber. They were hydraulically fed, and they were fed by people and the lads at the back who were taking off the thin pieces. Now, the timber would go in probably 3 inches wide and would come out at various thicknesses. And they had a wonderful system, peculiar to the box trade, of whatever you could get out of a 3-inch plank was determined the thickness. So if you wanted, for argument's sakes, half inch, you could get 5 bits of half inch out of a 3-inch. So the order was written down as 3/5. And the sawyer knew that that meant half an inch. Or 3/6 was slightly thinner, and 3/7 was about 3/8. And that was even thinner still. Now, eventually we went over to metrification when the government decided, and we were the first sawmill in Ireland to go over to metrification because it was so much easier than having to work about these 3/5, 3/6, 3/7, or whatever it was, or 3/4, which was 4 pieces out of a 3-inch. But that's the way the order was written out. So if you were making, say, 1,000 Bure coopers, and they were made out of wood, and you can still see them occasionally, but they're very rare now. You would need 2,000 ends, 2,000 sides, and maybe 3,000 bottoms. And the bottoms are always made of native timber, and the ends are made of imported timber. So the timber would be cut in multiples of, say, three or four for the ends, and maybe two or three for the sides. And then it was cross-cut after it had been
Yeah,
planed.
and imagining that the timber is so thin because it had to
Yeah.
be to for the manufacturing of these boxes and crates and so on.
Well, I mean, this was a low-cost product. It was a packaging product, and cost was what it was all about. Therefore, you were always trying to save wherever you could to make the cheapest possible container, because it was going to be, in a lot of cases, disposable. But the beer coopers used to come back. Now, the company made beer coopers. They made bread trays for the likes of Johnson Mooney and O'Brien, Boland's, Kennedy's, Kelly's Bakery of Kilcock, Haslam's of Birr, now that I think of another one. It made beer coopers for Irish ale breweries, for Guinness. They made whiskey bottles, boxes as well for Powers. They made the little naggins, which were the tiny little boxes so beloved of the lady with the handbag. And these were baby powers. They made boxes for packing cases as well, for the likes of Harry Clark, the stained glass people. Now, unfortunately, I never went to their studios to see the stained glass, but we used to make all their packing cases for export and all over the world and wherever they went. They would make fitted boxes for Coca-Cola. And the Coca-Cola box was specified by the Americans. And it was very precise specification. And if you didn't get it right, you got a real rocket and probably didn't get the business. But as there were only two companies in Dublin who could make Coca-Cola boxes, we actually had a little hold over the multinational, which was quite a nice thing to have, unlike today. But this box was a fitted box. It took two dozen Coca-Cola bottles. And there were wooden fittings, which are interlinked, so that there was a crisscross of timber narrow pieces. And they all had to be grooved so that they fitted into each other. And not only had to be grooved to fit into each other, they had to have a little slot as well at each groove so that they couldn't break off. It was immensely complex. And then the box, the sides were machined. They had to be rounded for people's hands. They had to be printed in a particular red. The Fanta was in blue. And the ends were hand-holed, which meant there was a place to put your hands in, as the beer coopers were. And this was done on a hand-hole machine made by a firm called Matthew Wiley. And I'll come back to them a bit more. But these boxes then were nailed on nailing machines, and then they were hooped, and this was done by hand, with galvanized hooping, which was about 1/2 inches wide, which we used to buy by the ton. And this was pulled round with a handbar and nailed all the way round. And that was the Coca-Cola box, just to drink the disgusting stuff that rots your teeth.
Was there a design center where all the planning and the measuring and the carefully designing of these boxes took place?
No, is the simple answer. There was the setup. We'll describe the setup of the personnel of the whole plant. There was the owner, who was a very, very fine lady called Sheila Connolly, and her family had descended from the Speaker Connolly of Castletown's house, from his family. Although he didn't have family, but she was connected or related to that family. And her name was spelled Connolly. It didn't have the two N's. Mm-hmm. So, she was a very talented lady, and her brothers and sisters were, or her brother and sisters were, very talented people as well. Her mother apparently owned the factory before she did, and it was left to her. And her father, I think, had built a lot of the churches in Glasnevin. And he had got into some problems during the First World War on fixed-term or fixed-price contracts. And there was a lot of inflation, I believe, after the First World War. And he, I think, you know, had a rough time of it. But so she ended up owning this factory, and she ran it. And then there was a managing director, a man called Mr. Austin. And then there was a mill foreman called Deneen. I think it was Morris Deneen. No, I'm not certain, but I think it was something like that. And he had a sister who ran the office. And it was one of these wonderful double-entry bookkeeping systems, which only she understood. I had the greatest difficulty understanding all these, I can remember, 10 different ledgers, which was deliberately kept so that nobody else would understand it. When she retired, we changed the system so that I'd have some idea of grasp of what this system was. There was a man who did travelling. He went out and just sort of called on customers and sold the boxes. And then there was myself, who supervised initially the assembly shop, which was upstairs, or the loft. And that is where we had, there's one other aspect to it. There were three trade unions in the plant: the transport and general workers, the sawyers, and the carpenters. Trade unions, and this was a little bit difficult, to put it simply, in such a small business with three different unions, and demarcation and restrictive practices, all the things that effectively put a lot of these small businesses out of business in the middle of Dublin. And it was very frustrating for myself coming back from abroad, where we haven't had that sort of thing, and with a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm, and wanting to try and make the place better and keep it going, because times were tough sometimes, and sometimes some years were reasonable, but sometimes there were bad years, and we needed to be as efficient as possible. And if we'd been allowed to do the things we had or wanted to do at the time we wanted to do, the business would have been a lot more successful. But it was held back by some of the restrictive practices that went on and the constant bickering that went on, not only between themselves, but with management. I found it very frustrating.
And did the workers at any stage, did they put down tools and walk out?
Many times.
And the different situations that you got yourself into with the trade unions, was there any compromise given at any stage?
Oh, there always is, yeah. I mean, they wanted the bread until one day the company had had enough and it had to close because it actually, the wooden coopers were going to be made, which were made basically for Irish Ale Breweries or Guinness Group, were going to be made next year in, I remember, we'll come back to it. Eventually, Guinness told us that the next season that they weren't going to buy wooden boxes anymore, that they were going to make them in a plastic factory, as all the beer cooper business went that way. And this represented for ourselves and our competitors, James O'Keefe, probably about 50% of our turnover. So that was a serious, there was no way the company would survive with that loss of turnover. And you could do all the downsizing you liked, but you're still left with basic overheads which had to be paid. And finally, the place was closed down, and some of the people just didn't believe that eventually the day would come when this would happen. We could foresee that this could happen. And if they hadn't taken that attitude, things might have been different. But anyway, that's all 30 years ago. That was the personnel structure of the place.
And that was in the 1960s?
That was in the 1960s, yeah. Sort of mid-1960s up to about 1970.
What did the place look like? I mean, that particular area wasn't exactly, I would imagine, a good place to have a factory at the time, or was it?
Well, it was quite interesting. There were, it was built on a bit of old Georgian Dublin, so much so that when we went to do some digging in the yard one time, we came across vast quantities of oyster shells, which had been the staple diet, as you know, of the Georgian Dublin. We also came across a shell which had been left there since 1916, and there had been a bomb factory on the site. And when we found this shell with a pickaxe, it caused consternation in the timber yard, and the whole place was evacuated, and the whole street was evacuated, and the army took it away. And I tried to persuade the lad not to hit it a second time, in case the thing went off. It was quite a big shell. But the yard was basically, there was a sort of dirt yard and there were piles of timber all around it. When I first went there, there was hardly any concrete flooring in the factory. The machines were sitting on foundations, concrete foundations. They were old Robinson woodworking machinery. Robinson were big machinery makers in England. There was an old Belgian bandsaw called a Dankert bandsaw. That never worked when I was there, and was eventually sold to somebody from Newcastle West, who arrived up and took it away, which was a great spectacle. But so I think one of the reasons why I'd been employed was because they knew the place was so run down that it needed re-equipping. And I had mechanical expertise, which I sort of naturally have. And I could understand, these sort of machinery and get it going. And we did a lot of we improved them vastly. But we also put down concrete on all the floors. All the waste, and you remember we're dealing with thousands of small pieces of timber every week, and it was just staggering what you would do. But the waste was also spectacular, and it used to get thrown off the back of a saw onto the floor, and they'd build up into huge piles. I mean, health and safety would have set the standards by how not to run a timber yard by looking at Leg Brothers' floors when I first went there. We had an accident book, and there were a few fairly regular entries into it one way or another, nothing terribly serious, but there were cuts and this, that, and the other. And So we got the floors. Sawdust was another big problem. We produced big quantities of sawdust every day. I think we probably produced a box that was 8 foot long by about 4 foot wide by about 6 foot high of sawdust every day. That's quite a lot of sawdust. And the waste timber was either loaded onto a lorry and taken off and dumped, or was put over a wall where there was a frightful scramble from all the local children to get whatever they could legally and illegally as well. It was quite a rough area in those days. And
Hill Street is Street. Off Parnell Street.
Yeah. Yeah.
And was it a rough area?
Well, you know, all of inner city was pretty tough, but there was great spirit about the place. It was a vibrant community. And I was there for 10 years, and my car was never damaged once. But I could walk up and down the street every day, and everybody else's car had been damaged. I suspect because I was part of the local employment scene that I was sort of, you know, don't touch that one. So they had their own sort of standards, you know. Yeah. Probably we wouldn't all agree with all of them. But
you were quite close to Nelson's Pillar. It was blown up around your time.
Yeah,
do you remember that?
I do actually. Yes, I mean I lived in somewhere the other side of Ball's Bridge or somewhere at the time, in one of the many flats, and I can remember the bang. But I can really remember the big bang when the government tried to demolish the rest of it, and it wasn't terribly successful. And there was huge damage all up and down the street. I also remember the car bombing as well, and one of the lads who worked in the sawmill, he was shaving, and the window went out in front of his face and landed in the street below him. He was a bit shook. But then we had a wonderful man who worked. He worked the main bandsaw. And he was working at night, and there was a raging storm going out, and there was a bit of this old Georgian wall was the edge of the factory. It wasn't any of these modern factories with steel. And this wall was waving in and out in the gust of wind. And I was in there, it was about 8 o'clock at night. And I said, Johnny, do you not think you'd stop this evening and just pack it up? Because that wall doesn't look great. It's going in and out. He said, I was in Korea. He said, that's nothing.
Was there a good, you know, morale between everybody actually working in the factory? You know,
yeah.
Generally, did
there
people
was,
get
yes,
on?
Yeah. And when you got on, everything was fine, you know. But it was an extraordinary situation. I had to wear a suit. I was only about 20 or something like that, but I had to wear a suit. Why? Because I was management. I had to wear a tie as well. So I had great trouble buying suits. I wasn't great at buying suits. Some woman in Arnott said, well, no, it doesn't suit you. And apparently I said, thank you very much. But I bought the damn thing. And when I got home, I got terrible trouble because it didn't suit me. And she was right. But and I was known as Sir by everybody. Totally disappeared now. Or Mr. Goodbody. And that was all. That's also gone now. Everything's Christian name terms now. But I think probably people respected me for my knowledge of what I knew, and we got on. But certainly there were times I quite willingly forget, because it was a very creative part of my early life, a lot of energy, and I wanted to do things. But the machinery side, as I said, there was Robinson's down below. Then we had the Stenner bandsaws. We had Wadkin crosscuts. Now, these are all well-known machinery things. And I set about applying compressed air to a lot of the operations, which are terribly repetitive and terribly hard. You know, you're pulling them, pushing them, pulling them, pushing. And then I built various machines as well. And I built a wonderful bandsaw, crosscut saw, which I think it just, all the pieces were fed through it sideways, and it just came out. And there were so many pieces coming out the far side, we had, I think, three or four lads trying to stack them all. One man was feeding them in. I built other machines for grooving timber, put pneumatic rams and a whole lot of things, did all sorts of things, conveyor we put in, we did all sorts of things, anything to make this thing as efficient as possible.
Was the turnout, you know, were these boxes coming out at a very fast pace?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, we would send out a lorry load of some days. I mean, I can remember lorries loading up with 500 and 600 bread trays and going out two or three times a day. So I mean, now you might build that stock up, but and the beer coopers, they'd go out too in big loads as well. We had one lorry which was loaded, took stuff. The boxes were let down a chute from the loft, and they went off. Now, we had to get rid of them. Storage was a space, was a problem. And of course, the bread trays only wanted, the bread companies only want bread trays coming up to the peak periods like Easter and coming up to Christmas and coming up to some of the other peak times. And the beer cooper people were much the same. But they were a little bit more. You could get rid of them, you know. But we...
There were other companies I think you made boxes for as well. Safety matches?
No.
Jacobs?
Well, I knew nothing about them. Well, Jacobs, we used to make pallets for them. They were very, very specific about their pallets. And Beamish and Crawford. Beamish and Crawford insisted on having hardwood pallets because they were a Canadian company. So we had to buy in what are known as hardwood mahogany shorts. Beautiful mahogany. I've got a lovely piece of big wide boards. I made my own dining room table out of one piece, which I salvaged. What went through ended up as a pallet. I mean, it's just unbelievable the way material was used for what it was used for. It was top grade mahogany, but it was short pieces and random widths, and it was suitable for pallets.
My God.
It was incredible. But we also bought native timber as well, and that came in as squares. And that was random widths, whatever they could get out of the log. And it came up in lorries. There's a firm called Nugent's over in RD Street who supplied us with native timber. And it was very rough. It was totally wet. And it was used for the bottoms of boxes and for the pallets as well. And, of course, eventually the pallet business all went to native timber. There was no more imported timber used pallets. But the upstairs, the assembly side is quite interesting because there were about six or seven people working on a bench in a long line on a bench, and they were doing the handwork, and they worked on a metal, solid pieces of metal cast iron, which to allow the nails to be clinched. And on the other corner of the loft, there were about four or five Matthew Wiley nailing machines. These were gang nailing machines. They were quite old, and they had a hammer, a whole series of hammers. The big ones had about eight hammers. And they had a chute which went down beside the hammer. And one nail was released by a little disc down into the chute. And when you pressed the pedal, an eccentric went round, a big sort of flywheel, and there was a crunch. And all eight nails just disappeared into whatever it was fired into. And not only underneath that, they had a bed which was serrated, which moved at the same time. So as the nail went through, when it got through, it was clinched over. It was a very clever machine.
Who designed that?
And that was designed by a firm called Matthew Wiley's in Glasgow. And we had, some of them were smaller ones, and they used to crunch, I mean, they could put in eight nails at a time. Now, the nails came from Irish Ware Products in Limerick, and the nails were all coated with a material, so you could bought bright nails or coated nails, and the bright ones were bright, as they say, but the coated ones were all decided to have more friction so that they wouldn't pull out. Now, later in the period, the pallet nails, which were longer, they were about 2.5 inches, they were all serrated nails. And when the serrated nail came in, which is now standard in all over the building trade, but it was a brilliant invention because it was like a barbed nail, and it went in and it wouldn't withdraw easily. And, of course, it's used now on marine workers' nails, for marine bronze nails as well for shipbuilding or boat building. But these nails we used to buy them by the ton, and they came up in bags, 100-weight bags, and we'd have those. So they were done. So the machines would do a lot of this sort of work, but then there was hooping, and there was another machine which did the wire which went round the end of a beer cooper. And it was a clever machine as well. You put it on, the wire was brought right around the end of the box. It was a twist joint was done, and it was cut, and you could get, they were really fast, you know, a fella good could do, and that was a box wire band. So then they were thrown along the floor or disappeared along the floor some other way by a truck. It was an old wooden floor, so it wasn't great. And they went along, and there were little air tackers. So we bought millions of staples, and the staples were tacked in over the wire. Bang, 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 bang. It's the Senko stapler. They were, that was the pneumatics part of it. So that did that side of, that was that side of it. The boxes had to be printed in a lot of cases. And I think when the company sold the bronze, about 3 tons of bronze printing dyes and things were sold. At the
was
time.
That carried out in the plant? Or
yeah. And that was also, there were two types of printing. There was the cropper type of printer. Now, you know what the cropper is, do you?
Yes.
The cropper.
You press down.
You press down and the arm comes up and you get really tired. You lose your arm because you leave it in there. But what you did was you, as the plate went down, you put in your piece of wood and then it went up. And it got pressed against the die, which was inked in the meantime. And then it came out again. You took it out and you put another one in, you see. And that was how that was done. So small runs were done that way. But big runs were done on a rotary printer. And we used to, you have to have dies which were mounted or printed, I suppose the print, anyway, was either set up in brass type or we used to get the lead type cast from the newspaper type thing, and we would mount that on this circular cylinder, and the timber was passed underneath this with a chain conveyor, and it was printed usually in one color, but it was done.
And was the ink soaked up? I'm just imagining again the wood would be like blotting paper. Would it soak a lot of the dye into the wood?
This didn't happen. I mean, initially they were that the ink did dry. But remember, all the printing was done onto dried timber. The imported timber was all dry. And of course, softwood dries very quickly anyway. But we never printed the native timber, and not that I can remember. It was too wet. But it dried and it was okay. But there were some lovely ones. There were some lovely wine ones. I kept one or two of them. There was a 3-star brandy. I think it must have been pretty low quality brandy, but it wasn't 5-star. But there were some beautiful, lovely wine one, which I still have. And
were different colors used?
They were mostly red and black, and I think blue sometimes, but it was very basic. It wasn't multicolored printing, no. And the Coca-Cola, they had Fanta, they were blue. The Coca-Cola was a particular type of red. All the Johnson Mooney's, Kelly's, and all those sort of people, they all had black. I think it was brown on one occasion. Downs's Bakery was another one. So that's what it is. The other thing, just to go back to the timber coming in on the ships, it was bought by the standard, and it was known as the Petrograd standard. This was, nowadays, is bought by the cubic meter. I mean, the metrification has destroyed all these wonderful things. But I just want to go back on this because there was you could buy timber by the Petrograd standard. And it was 165 cubic feet per standard. Mm-hmm. There was also a Dublin standard, because Ireland had to be different, earlier. And it was 272 cubic feet per standard. And we never bought it with the Dublin, but I happen to know that. And in the desk of the sort of sawmill office, because I ended up running the sawmill, eventually I ended up as manager of the whole plant, but there was a wonderful slide rule which did all the calculations involved in timber measurement, including how to calculate the girth of a tree at quarter breast high, quarter girth, which is, you know, at breast high, the quarter girth of a tree, you could calculate how much timber was in that tree. And this was all done in this wonderful wooden slide rail rule. And unfortunately, it's disappeared, but it really would be a lovely thing to have, you know.
Yes, it would. And that particular type of measuring was unique at the time, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yes. Nowadays, it's all metric. And nowadays, everything is done in cubic meters, and it's all the timber's lengths are all metricated, widths and thicknesses are all metricated. And of course, the sizes are vastly reduced. There are very few sizes now compared to what they used to be. We used to be able to buy 3 by 11, 3 inches by 11 inches wide at one time. You can't buy that anymore.
Yeah, because the tree was allowed to grow longer.
Yeah, well,
the trunk was.
Yeah, the timber came in from some of the Russian season used to open up when the ice thawed, and the Russians were they would have a contract price for all their timber, and they had, I think we bought what's known as Russian fourths at the time, and then there was another grade called unsorted. Unsorted was that it really wasn't graded, so you got good and bad, but then the Swedes and basically Sweden and Finns. They sold unsorted and fourths and fifths grades. Now, fifths was basically used, that grade was used basically in the construction business, in roofs and all the rest of it. Fourths was better, was used for joinery. But unsorted was, I think, the top grade, and it was used for top quality joinery. In fact, we very seldom sort. But the sixth was the rubbish, which ended up in boxes. So that was basically it.
You were the Smurfit of the time. You were the packaging, the boxing. When cardboard started to come in, did you feel the pinch at that stage?
Well, by coincidence, Smurfits went on to do much better things than I ever managed to do. But we did actually share the same. We were opposite stands in one of the packaging exhibitions in the RDS, and Smurfits were the other side. Michael Smurfit was selling boxes like the best of them. We were trying to sell wooden ones. But the Smurfits, of course, and packaging became an essential part of selling something. In other words, it was the packaging that sold the product. I mean, there is more value in the packaging than there is in the cornflake that you eat today. That's when Smurfit took off. They had their plant in, I think it was Clonskilly, where they started off, and corrugated was just coming in. Now, Mr. Orson, who'd worked with me, had been in Canada, and he had been in a big plant out there. He had worked in Brooks Thomas, but he went out to Canada, and he had this big plant, and they had the corrugated. They were making corrugated out there and using it for packaging. So that's what Smurfit picked up on the idea, I expect, from America, and set up the first corrugated plant in Ireland, and then went from strength to strength. We were, of course, still doing one-off things like wooden packing cases. Wooden packing cases for machineries will still be made out of wood, or because you have to do it, or else they're put into a container and there's a lot of waste space around it. But basically, you still see engines and things coming in on wooden bearers, packing, and specialized stuff will come in wooden packing cases. Wooden bread trays are still made. They're actually made down in East Galway. There's a place down there, and I know. Anyway, Tina, I think it is, and I know they were still making wooden bread trays up until quite recently. But otherwise, the beer tray, the plastics took over, and corrugated took over in a lot of the things they did, and a lot of things have just gone to different ways of selling them, so they didn't require, the packing anymore. So that's it was inevitable that business was going to disappear.
But did you think there was almost a craft in the production of the boxes? They were handmade to a great extent.
It depends how you define the word craft. I mean, I could never see any reason why it took 5 years or 7 years to train an apprentice to beat nails into a box. The reality was that he could learn to do it in about a fortnight. Although Rudyard Kipling said it took a man half a year to learn how to use a hammer properly. Now, there were some very skilled people with hammers. One of the more interesting things while we're on that subject is the hammer was a particular shaped hammer. It had a spike in one end because one of the businesses, there was big business, but it was very low cost, was fish boxes for fish. And they were all bound with hoop. They had to be because they went out in fishing boats in some cases, and of course they got as rusty as hell, you see. So they had to be fairly strong, and they ended up, I suppose, in Billingsgate or wherever it was. But anyway, to do this, you put the hoop round it, and you pull the hoop with a bar which had a slot in it, and it caught the hoop and pulled it, and then you couldn't drive a nail through that, so you turned the hammer over, and with the pointed end you banged a hole all the way along, and then you drove your nails in with the other side of the hammer. And these people got very skilled with their hammers. And I can remember one man doing this sort of work, and he'd be carrying on a conversation that you and I are carrying on, and be banging away with his hammer and occasionally looking at the hammer and the nail just to see where the next one is going to go. I mean, he was just practically automatic.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? But I mean, these were the men at the time that could. What about women? Were there women working in the
No,
factory?
no, no. We had the lady who looked after the books.
And she was the controller, if you like, of watching the finances come and go.
She watched it all, and of course, it all went upstairs then to Sheila Connolly's office, where everything was poured over. Sheila Connolly used to walk around the plant every day with me, and when she came in about latter years, about 12 o'clock, she would walk around the plant. She could see everything that was going on. She knew everything that was going on. She knew about the problems, wanted to know about them, and you had to talk to her about what the hell the whole thing was going, which was a very good form of management. I didn't have any problem with it at all. I learned an awful lot from her, and well able to apply what she taught me later on to my own advantage. But to come back to hammering, because this subject is even more interesting. In my own amusements now, what I do myself, I've got 7 or 8 different hammers. They all do different jobs. But one of the most, or two of the most interesting hammers were the ones used for tensioning the saw blades. If you had a circular saw, and you might, let's say the blade was about 1 meter in diameter, that would be a big one, but some of them are a bit smaller, but a lot of them were that size. As the saw spins, it builds up stresses inside the steel. And then it starts cutting. And as it starts cutting, the outside of the outside gets warm, so it expands. So you actually have to expand the inside and put it under expansion, if you like, so that when the outside heats up when it saws, the whole saw will run true. So this was done by a hammer. And a very good saw doctor, and he was the most highly skilled person of the whole lot. I still take my hat off to the saw doctors. They were very skilled people. They would go around, and they had a very heavy anvil set up on a bench, and they had these hammers, and they could just hammer them just the right amount to shift the steel out, and they could get that saw blade into expansion, and then it would run true when it was set up and was spinning on the saw. And the next thing they did was they had the bandsaws, and the bandsaw blade was about 5.5 inches wide. That's of, say, 130 millimeters wide. And they were 25 feet long. And that's quite a lot of steel. And they were probably, I suppose, 2 mil thick or thereabouts. The bandsaws, they also had problems. And they used to get, you used to get lumps in them. And these people would go along with a straight edge. And they would check the bandsaw. If they saw a lump, they'd hammer it until they got the lump out of it. And they got the whole bandsaw running true. And then, because it was flexing all the time, there was a brazed joint in a bandsaw blade. It was brazed by the people who made the blade. But sometimes these used to give trouble, and they used to crack. So you'd have to look for those. And then the bandsaws, they did another problem. They used to start cracking. And the reason why they cracked was the bandsaw pulleys used to get sawdust, gummy sawdust, building up on the leading edge and putting more stresses on this blade. So they used to crack. And when a bandsaw blade had started giving trouble, you had to take it off. They were sharpened by an automatic sharpening machine. They were then, the tooth was then, sorry, first of all, the tooth was compressed. And then it was sharpened on the face and over the back. And then it was swaged or swaged on the side. And then it was sharpened. This was three different things, apart from the saw doctor going around and checking it for lumps. He also had a roller, which was running continuously. And he could run the bandsaw blade backwards and forwards under this roller and roll out the lumps. But they'd follow a lump down a bandsaw blade for 2 or 3 feet in some cases.
Oh, my God. You can imagine you would have to have a good eye to spot this.
Oh, yes. And they were very skilled people. And I remember them in England. They were the saw doctor was the most skilled person in the whole plant. Everybody else could think they were, but he was. And also the ones who were brazing, they had to do really good brazing, braze joints, which then had to be ground off afterwards, and they did the joint. So they were fascinating. And the bearings were enormous bearings. I mean, we used to occasionally we changed the bearings on the bandsaw pulleys. The bandsaw pulley was about 1/4 ton, and that was spinning around at 600 RPM. So you had these enormous roller bearings. They were the same as what they have on the wheels of trains. And we used to have to take these off, and it was quite an involved job. And lifting 1/4 ton, you know, you had to set it all up. It was quite a job. And they every so often they had to be ground. And a specialist firm used to come over from England and grind them with a grinder, which he set up on them. But that was the hammer was the key hand tool.
What about training apprentices into this? Or, like you said, did it just take two weeks to learn how to hammer a nail into?
Well, let's say that's what it took. Now, obviously, you had to know there were certain patterns you had to put into Say you had seven or eight boards going across, and then you had a batten going across. Well, that would need nails set out in a pattern. There was quite a lot more to it. Let's say 2 weeks to hammer a nail, but after that, it was sort of general knowledge about the product that you were making. But it was quite easy to do, and it could have been written down on a piece of paper, and anybody could have read it. I mean, nowadays it would be very low technology. When you say it's a craft thing, I don't consider it was very high skilled craft.
But at the height of its of being there, the production. How many boxes were leaving the plant? I mean, you mentioned that there were three loads going to bakeries.
Yeah.
Yes.
It would have been probably 1,000 or maybe 2,000 items a week would go out of the place. I mean, the lorry would go out with 500 or 600. It might go out twice a day. So let's say it was, it could have been 2,000 or 3,000. I know when I later went on to run I set up a sawmill to run or cut pallet boards for the pallet business, because that's what really became the major packaging material in timber, in small timber, still is. But we used to export a load to the north of Ireland, and I think 10,000 pieces of timber went onto that lorry, onto a 40-foot lorry, and it went to North Ireland once a week. And
nice.
Then there were other pieces going off to other places as well. I mean, that was quite big, with basically much the same machinery.
Was it seasonal in the sense that, did you have your highs and lows?
Yeah, coming up to Christmas was busy. And after Christmas, like everything else, even today, there wasn't a penny in the pocket to be spent. It had all gone and drink and all the other things that goes on over Christmas. But after Christmas was flat, and then you used to build up again for Easter. And then during the summer, we used to close down in August for 2 weeks. That was the annual sort of builder's holiday, and everything stopped. And we did a little bit of maintenance sometimes then, but generally the maintenance went on while we were doing it, as we had to do it. Of course, it was ongoing because there were an awful lot of moving parts and things that had to be sort of looked after.
Were you the first in there making pallets, or was that something that you had seen coming on the market?
I think we were the first, from what I remember. We actually, the company had a building across the road, directly opposite from where we were across the street, and it was quite a big shed. And we set up a pallet operation there. We used to make a lot of pallets for Gouldings, and they were very heavy. We made all the pallets for Irish distillers, and this was great. So if you go down to Middleton Distillery, you'll see whiskey up there and pallets that I probably made years ago.
Who came up with the idea?
Oh, I suppose it was, I mean, forklifts were known at that stage. They were being used. They were used down the docks and places like that. It was quite logical that pallets should come in. I'm sure they came from the UK. But, I mean, later on, I got involved in a pallet operation out in Shankill, which was jointly owned by Legg Brothers and James O'Keefe of East Wall Road. And we had a Matthew Wiley machine there for nailing pallets. And I think it nailed... 24, something like 24 nails at a time, at a bang. I mean, and this was a machine that you could put a 4 foot wide pallet through it, and there were five bearers in the pallets. So you set up the pallets on a jig. You put the pieces of timber on the top. You put the first one in, and bang, you pushed it forward, went bang, you pushed it forward again, bang, bang, bang. So you nailed the whole pallet in about a minute. And then you had to turn the pallet over, by the way, and nail the other side as well.
When this all started, were you excited about this? Like, did you see that this was going to be the new way of shifting and moving things? You know, the day of putting a bag of flour in your back and hacking it and hauling it, and now you could take 20 or 30 bags on top of a pallet.
Associating my name with sacks at this stage, but we'll leave that one.
Yes, indeed. Think that you were from the jute factory. Yes,
but
indeed.
I wasn't actually in the jute factory. But the, transport was changing, and bulk loads were coming in, and industry was beginning to sort of lift a bit. But I probably wasted my time, if you think about it, working in such a business which was obviously doomed. If you went to a really smart consultant, you'd say, just forget that, get into something else. It's, plastic's going to be, or whatever it's going to be, But I didn't have any qualifications, so this is what I did. And I'm quite happy. I had good fun out of it.
But in a way, this kind of ran in the family, because if you go back down to Clara in County Offaly, and where you did have the jute factory run by your ancestors, I mean, these were people who saw sacking disappearing as well, and were hit by plastics and...
Yeah, I mean, the whole world was changing over to plastics. I mean, oil was cheap, it's unlike today. It's going to be very interesting how they're going to package a lot of things now when oil runs out. The world's got a lot of thinking to do, but it's going to change. But I suppose I should have gone to university, and I would have had a wider view of what was going on. But fortunately, I didn't, because I probably ended up in some godforsaken place like Scunthorpe or Immingham, or, you know, with these awful ICI plants with frightful pollution and a short life expectancy. So I'm glad I didn't.
But you obviously put your heart and soul into this place. When you arrived there, you got into it, and you were interested in pushing it along, which you did too, and came all the way up to managing director of the company.
I did eventually, and then we had to decide it was carried on a limited scale after I left, because I was moved out to set up a new operation down in Wicklow, in a new sawmill down there. And we stayed in that, I think, for 4 years. And then my wife and I decided to get out and do our own thing. And we left the pallet box making wood industry completely. And we went over to the marine industry.
Were you happy to walk away from that?
Well, you always like a change. I mean, I've had 3 or 4 changes in my lifetime. And if you don't have change, if anybody thinks everything's going to go on the same, that it's always going to go on, they're living in cloud cuckoo land. Life evolves, it changes, and that's exciting. It's there's something to do. I mean, you've got to bring up a family and get a roof over your head and do all the necessary things, but change is fun.
There must have been a stage when you saw the writing on the wall. You saw, you know, somebody coming into you saying, look, Guinnesses are going to be changing over to plastic soon, and that was going to affect your business greatly. Did that happen?
Well, the position was that I was really involved in the plant. I wasn't out on the marketing side. In fact, I really didn't go out and meet clients or customers as was such. The traveller for the company, he did that, and the managing director did that as well. But I really wasn't involved in that. But obviously it would have been discussed, and because we had coffee every morning and together, and we would discuss the general problems going on, and I'm sure it just got discussed that way. But eventually somebody said, well, Guinness is going to plastics next year, and how it came I just don't know, but that's what they had. They were a very good company. I had dealings with Guinness's afterwards. I have a very high regard for Guinness's compared to some of the other people we've dealt with, and Guinness's obviously didn't want to just say no more boxes the day before you're expecting you're going to get an order. You know, they were saying 6 months. Be prepared. This is what's going to happen. Make your own arrangements, but we're giving you plenty of notice. And that's what they did. And it was a very honourable way of doing it. I mean, so that's probably what happened. But I don't remember it, apart from the fact we then did it. Costs. Mr. Austin was trained in cost accounting. And I also did a certain amount of that in Rath Mines. That's when I could stay awake. So having done an 8-hour day on the floor on your feet, the first hour you slept in Rath Mines, and then you woke up for the next 2 hours. And that was tough. But I studied cost accounting, and I'd also studied some in England as well. So I was reasonably familiar in how to build up costs and quotations and costs of what things were costing us. And eventually in the plant, we brought in, somebody else came in who did actual planning of work going through the place. So that helped as well, because it was a very complex thing to manage. You're having to make sure that the men were fully occupied, were on the various machines. And of course, some of them would only work particular machines. They wouldn't work other machines. And one man could only work one machine and nobody else was able to work it. And there was a lot of this going on, you know, so you had to sort of make sure that everything flowed. And you had to tie in with deliveries that are required, because somebody would ring up and say, we're needing 1,000 bread trays in 3 days' time, and you've got to see whether you can get them. And it was very, very tricky to do this. So costs came into it, and you know, I was reasonably familiar with that type of thing. I couldn't understand bookkeeping, but I could understand that all right.
Yes.
And it was... But I suppose because I was in the plant, I wasn't out on the coal face, if you like, and driving around, which probably would have been more interesting, and I would have seen more opportunities, and I probably wouldn't have stayed there. I probably would have moved into something else, which had a, better.
Yeah, but you know, I suppose in a way, like you said, the world was changing, everything was changing, and people now were demanding more instant, more efficient type of boxing.
Yeah, I mean, everything was, all sorts of things has changed. I mean, the change that I have seen in my short lifetime is absolutely been phenomenal in communications, in getting hold of knowledge, in handling things, packaging things, plastics, computers, all these things have come up in my lifetime. Even the jet engine was only developed during my lifetime. And you think of the importance of that. So it's been an exciting time to be alive. I've certainly had great fun out of observing it. And yeah, it's exciting. And then you had some stimulating leaders. I mean, I can remember the extraordinary atmosphere when Kennedy was assassinated. And it was just it was it was an exciting time. And then the nightlife in Dublin was terrific as well. There was Ronnie Drew and the Dubliners, and all these people were at their height, the Beatles. I remember working with a fellow in England who used to go and drink in the same pub as the Beatles did in Liverpool.
Oh, is that right? And so it was the swinging Dublin at the time. You were in living out in Dublin for, were you? And you were coming into work in the morning.
Yeah, when I went to work at 8 o'clock in the morning, there was nobody else. I remember getting caught for speeding around Stephen's Green at 10 to 8 in the morning in Dublin. Speeding, if you don't mind. Only once or twice in my life. But the it was, I mean, nobody went to work. I mean, all the legal profession, the lawyers and the accountants, none of them ever went got into their office before 10 o'clock in the morning. They had lunches of 2 and 3 hours. And they shifted off home, some of them about 4 o'clock, and some of them worked a bit harder. But I mean, I put in a 40, I think it was 44-hour week when I first went there, and we used to do 10 hours of overtime, and I had to put in my 10 hours of overtime. So when I moved out to Strafford, where I bought a house with my wife on the edge of the canal, you just look forward to the Saturday off when there was no overtime. But I used to work 2 nights a week up till 9 o'clock. And that was tough.
And you just got stuck in, and
You just got
you
stuck
didn't
in.
worry about, your time off or anything.
Well, you did. I mean, the other thing was that I didn't quite toe the party line because I said, well, 5 o'clock. Listen, I've been in here since 8. It's 5 o'clock. I'm now going home. Oh, but, nobody else in Dublin goes home before 6. I said, well, that's different. Maybe they haven't worked hard enough, but I've worked hard. I've done everything. I'm up to date, and I'm going home. But it doesn't look very good. Well, I said, maybe it doesn't, but that's what I'm doing. As I wanted a home life, and I had a home life. And of course, eventually I went out and worked myself, and I worked just as hard. I mean, my average working week, I suppose most of my life up until the last 10 years, was probably 60, 70, 80 hours a week, if you added it all up, between working for the company and working for myself.
But you have enjoyed, have you enjoyed all those days
I had a
going
great
to
life. Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Finally, Reg, before we finish, your highs and your lows, your own personal high in Leg Factory and your low.
It's hard to know. I've never really thought of it that way. I'm reasonably optimistic. I get on with it. I'm a bit impulsive. I make decisions. I do things. But, if you don't make decisions, you don't get anything done. Yes, I've had some highs. I suppose a high in my life came way after that when I retired, when I now carve half models of boats to scale. And I had an exhibition, and I sold 70% that night. I couldn't
Of
believe
course. Wonderful success.
That was a high. We've had lows too. You've had board, we've had my wife and I've had board meetings at 5 o'clock in the morning. Like anybody who's runs their own family business, and we've had our problems. We in later life we had a year when we lost a lot of money. It took a year and a half to break even. So for 2.5 years we had made nothing. We just got a salary out of it. That's not very stimulating. you know, you need something to make a profit to keep going.
To keep going.
Yeah.
Reggie Goodbody, thank you again very much for telling me your story. Thank you.